It really is a great honor to be here at this social ministry gathering. I've been to several of them in the past, and there's a great work of this partnership, and there's a great grace, obviously, that it provides the church, a necessary grace and a necessary component of the church. But since the work of, I think, all of you deal with this question of communicating and living out the church's social teachings, I'd like to start off with a couple, what I think is a significant challenge in this work that we do in terms of the Catholic social tradition. I'd like to do it in two ways. One, a personal story, and the second, my role as a teacher that I've been doing for many years. First is a personal story. I grew up on the south side of Chicago in a blue-collar neighborhood, and both my parents are Irish immigrants. And I was 16, and I was walking out the door one day, and my father looked at me. He says, Michael, you'd be a good boy, Michael. I said, sure, Dad, whatever. And before I can take another step, he looked at me and he said, Michael, what did he say? Now I forgot, right? He said, if you can't be good, you be careful. I said, all right, I'll try that. Well, an unfortunate event happened to me that night, and my father had to pick me up from a Chicago police station. I'll spare you the details about why that was the case. But he walked into the police station, he looked at me and he said, Michael, I think you better just be good. Well, my father and I had lots of issues to work out through those many years, but the story illustrates, I think, a particular problem, because we live in a culture that is somewhat fixated on the issue of being careful. We have designated drivers, right? Safe and careful drivers who take home drunk and stupid friends. We somehow think that non-productive, disease-free sex can make up its own unitive and procreative meaning, so we talk about safe sex. We have an educational system that, in a sense, constantly talks about good test scores, checking all the boxes, getting to the next step, and yet our students have lost the love of learning. We have people who are involved in career strategies always figuring out what do they do, how do they do it, what can get to the next place. And they've lost sight of what it means to work and the very nature of work. All this talk that we often kind of deal with, and as parents, we do it all the time. I do it with my own children. But I'm being careful, it often distracts us from the deeper question of the good, of the common good, of those goods that bind us together in the work that we do, that give us the capacity to promote what we call in this tradition the integral human development. And thus, we have to kind of work on this idea of decentering from the modern mind, this utilitarian mindset that is a great challenge for the future. I raise that because this year I started my 30th year teaching, and I have found two fundamental challenges in trying to communicate this beautiful, wonderful tradition that we call the Catholic social tradition. The first is, how do you enlarge the hearts of the student? How do you enlarge the heart of the student? Matter of fact, I would even say, how do I enlarge my heart to teach those students? Augustine has this wonderful line from the Confessions when he says, the house of my soul is too small for you to come to it. May it be enlarged by you. So the idea of an enlarged heart, not just for my students, but also for myself. And second to that is also, how do I enlarge the mind of my students? How do I enlarge them in such a way that as they go out into the complicated and difficult practice of leading institutions, how can I help them understand that this tradition has so much to say to them? And so this challenge and these challenges that, again, are not just with my students, but they're also with me, is, I think, can be very helpful in terms of the title of this talk, which is about what we call the power of the imagination and the importance. And so what I'd like to do is simply two things in my talk. One is, I'd like to talk about this power of the imagination in the Catholic social tradition. And I won't spend a lot of time on it, but I'd like to kind of just lay it out where I think, what is it, and what are the challenges that go along with it. And then I'd like to kind of go down to the practical, about how does this power impact this question that many of us always address is what we might call the just wage. How does it begin to operationalize itself in the question of wages? Okay. So let me start off my talk, or the first part of this talk, by a quote by Barbara Ward. I don't know if many of you know, she was a Catholic British economist, wrote quite a bit in the 60s about sustainable development before people even mentioned the word. And I think she captures very well this idea of the imagination. And Barbara Ward says this. She says, "The most important change that people can make is to change their way of looking at the world. We can change studies, jobs, neighborhoods, even countries and continents, and still remain as we always were, but change our fundamental angle of vision and everything changes. Our priorities, our values, our judgments, our pursuits." And it's this last sentence that I think is most profound. Again and again in the history of religion, this total upheaval in the imagination has marked the beginning of a new life, a turning of the heart, a metanoia by which men see with new eyes and understand with new minds and turn their energy to new ways of living. This idea of seeing, of judging, of acting, such an important part of our tradition. And in particular, this word, the upheaval of the imagination, is such of a critical importance that we have to be upheaved in this idea, that there's a reality there that often we haven't quite penetrated, and the imagination is of critical importance. And yet, even the word imagination is an unfortunate one, because so many of us think of a kind of Disney imagination that doesn't actually penetrate reality, but disconnects us from reality. It doesn't reveal reality, but often conceals it. But in the tradition, in the Catholic tradition, the idea of the imagination is a human power. It's a power of the soul, which attends to the deep memory that's within us to help us make present that which is invisible. We speak about the sacramental imagination. It's where the visible sign reveals the invisible reality. And even in the very word itself, imagination, image, image. The imagination can help us see the image of God in the other, rather than simply a function or a utility or simply a series of body parts. So this imagination is helpful in terms of trying to create a vision for us. And let me highlight what I think are three things that this imagination needs to provide for us in a more general way. The first one is that it helps us see things whole and not just the parts. John Henry Newman has argued that educating the student in the habit of mind to see things in relationship to each other, to form nature, to form judgments about the encounter of realities that's in front of you, and to see things how related. There's a very interesting philosopher, some of you may know him, his name is Alistair MacIntyre. And MacIntyre has argued that, in a sense, much of university education has, in a sense, prevented this. In fact, much of education, particularly higher education, has become a highly narrow and specialized training that has produced minds that are incapable of seeing things in relationship with each other. MacIntyre provocatively goes on to say that the current economic crisis, the Iraq War, the Middle East, the growing inequality, even going back all the way to the Iran crisis back in the 70s, are all kind of examples of misjudgments of the intellectual elite, often trained at the most prestigious of universities, who have failed to see things whole. One wants to be careful of laying all that on them, but there is a sense that their problem was not specialization. Their problem was often that they couldn't see the relationship of things in terms of how they acted. Again, specialization is a very important thing. It has great benefits, but its fundamental danger is always that it can lack imagination. The second issue that I like to point out is that an imagination helps us to see fact and value and not just numbers. I'm not quite sure about your institution, but ours, you constantly hear the slogans, if it can't be measured, it doesn't exist, right? We have to be data-driven. which is true. And big data and analytics is a very important science that one wants to take very seriously. But the problem of data and the problem of measurement is sometimes you can, in a sense, drive the spirit out of the thing. Data and measurements never exhaust the reality in front of us. T.S. Eliot has that wonderful line, "Where is the wisdom we've lost in our knowledge? Where is the knowledge we've lost in our information?" And thirdly, the idea of seeing beyond neighbors to fraternity. Benedict has, in Caritas in Veritate, I'm sure many of you know it, he says, "As society becomes ever more globalized, it makes us neighbors, but does not make us brothers. Reason by itself is capable of grasping the equality between men and of giving stability to their civic coexistence, but it cannot establish fraternity. This originates in a transcendent vocation from God the Father, who loved us first." Let me give you one quick example of this. I have a friend of mine. He's a former CEO of a construction company down in Mexico City. He's Mexican. And he once said to me, he said, "You know, he's met a lot of CEOs from the United States, and he says a lot of them are very good people, men and women. But he says, often when I talk about a CEO, they often only see the employee as simply a function. They often just see that." He says, while Mexico has plenty of problems, it's not a perfect place, he says, "There is a deep sense of family within the Mexican culture that I see a mother and a father and a brother and a sister. And when you see that, you're going to do different things when you see in that way." I mentioned there's a lot of challenges to this idea of seeing, this imaginative vision. And there are so many of them. I think the ubiquity of technology that we're dealing with right now, the kind of phenomenon of pornography, the problem of alcoholism, problem of workaholism, all these things can get in the way. But let me highlight two particular challenges as it relates to the question of imagination. And the first one is what I would call ideology. Ideology distorts the moral imagination. Sometimes we have to face it, right, that people become weary of the Catholic social tradition because too often it can get hitched or hijacked to an ideology that short-circuits the deeper understanding of the issue that one has at hand. And let me highlight two of these ideologies. The first one is what we might call the logic of the contract, often associated with maybe the left, or the liberal, or the progressive ideology. The idea here is that if we just get one more law, we will get justice, right? Just one more. And there's an idea of this great faith in the contract and the law of the social contract, that that is the thing that will often exhaust the notion of what justice is about. This, you see, actually translated often into administrators. And I don't mean to be picking on administrators, but there is a sense of what we might call a proceduralism. When a judgment is to be made, we look to the handbook, we look to the organizational chart, somehow thinking that that's going to exhaust the idea of finding a solution to the answer at hand. The logic of the contract is a very important logic. Procedures are very important. Processes are very important. But when people get too fixated on them, as von Balthasar points out, when law no longer has love, it grows very cold. And an organization will grow very cold. The second logic, or the second ideology we might call, is the logic of the market. This is best described to me. I did a survey one time of business faculty at Catholic universities, and one of the person I was interviewing was in the finance department, and this is what he was complaining about his finance colleagues, and he said this about him. He says, "If I believed in God as much as they believed in the market, I would be a mystic." We too often justify all sorts of suffering and pain in terms of subliving wages and all sorts of different things because it's simply the market. The market cannot exhaust the reality in front of us. And yet the logic of the market, like the logic of the contract, is a very important logic to understand reality. So these two logics, I think, are particularly problematic and they need to be ordered by something larger. But before I get to that, let me go to the next, I think, particular challenge of this imagination, and it has to do with abstraction. And it, in many respects, has to do with us. Because sometimes we describe the Catholic social tradition in such abstract ways that they lose their power. They become impotent. Francis says this recently. He says, "We are always in danger," he says, "of turning our great social principles into mere generalities which challenge no one." This is a serious problem. A friend of mine who is the former dean of Santa Clara's business school, Andre Del Beck, says, "We seem to often have a sense of what they yearn for, but behavioral specificity is rather thin." And by the way, I think the real problem here for this problem of abstraction is actually not the Pope, it's not the bishops. I would say it's more academics who haven't done a very good job translating these principles into the practical realities that we find ourselves in. So these are challenges, and what I think we need most deeply for these challenges to be encountered is what we call a logic of gift. It's this logic of gift which is the soil of the imagination that gives us the vision to see things whole, to see into the depths of things. Again, Newman says, he says, "The real battles of life often take place within the human imagination." And that often that this logic of gift is too often, in a sense, misplaced. And this is where I think the Catholic social tradition is all about, the idea of revealing and fostering this logic of gift. There's a lot more to be said about this logic of gift, a lot more to be said about the idea of the imagination. But let me turn right now to this more specific issue of a kind of a case study that I would call in terms of just wages and how we can deal with that problem. I'd like to highlight three issues with the idea of a just wage. And the first one is, what does this religious imagination help us to see in relationship to a just wage? And then, what are the moral convictions of this religious imagination that we take into dealing with the question of a just wage? And then I'd like to talk a little bit about how this view can be institutionally embodied. How does it begin? What does it begin to look like institutionally if we take it seriously? I use the just wage as such an illustration. I think it could be done on all and so many other different issues, but just to give an illustration of what this might look like. But before I begin, I have to tell you, to give you what I consider my favorite quote on just wages. And it comes from an English clergyman in 1822, and it goes like this. "Our incomes are like our shoes. If too small, they gall and pinch. But if too large, they cause us to stumble and trip." So, let me go into this idea of what we might call the logic of justice as it relates to it, which, by the way, as Benedict pointed out in Caritas in Veritate, is so intimately connected to the logic of love, the logic of gift that I was just talking about. Let me highlight a few words about this. A just wage is different than simply a market wage or a wage contract. They may be the same. They may find themselves expressed. A market wage can be a just wage. A contract wage can be a just wage. But contracts and markets do not exhaust the understanding of what we mean by justice. There's a man, again, I mentioned Alistair MacIntyre, who's written a lot about the idea that when we use the word justice, we have within the United States so many different traditions of justice that we have to be careful that we're often not talking about the same thing. And when we speak about it, particularly in the Catholic tradition, certainly I do, and I'm sure there's probably some debates about this, but I'm particularly concerned, I'm particularly kind of drawing from a Thomistic vision. And Thomas's fundamental insight of justice is about what Jay just mentioned, is about right relationships. It comes from a Latin word, jus, which means right. Right relationships. Not my rights to do whatever I want, not my rights to my particular autonomy, but my right to be in relationship with others. That's at the heart of the idea. And so whenever we speak about justice, we should always be speaking about the idea of what does it look like to have a real relationship in terms of what we're talking about. And so when we talk about a just wage, we're talking about what is the nature of a real relationship in the nature of the wage. And so let me get to what I think is the heart of what the Church's understanding of a just wage is. And it's a difficult insight. And I struggle often communicating this. So let me just warn you beforehand. But here's what I think is the fundamental insight of that wage. that at the heart of it is not simply an exchange of equivalence, but is a relationship. And so it says in this slide, in order for there to be a right relationship between employee and employer, both need to recognize that work can never be reduced to or exhausted by the wage given. The wage given can never fully account for the labor done, precisely because work is always more than its economic output or instrumental value. This imaginative insight, what I would call the imaginative insight of wages, is actually the most difficult thing to understand about the church's notion of a just wage. By the way, this is not something that I created. This actually I found, there's a wonderful book by Joseph Pieper called Leisure, the Basis of Culture, where he pretty much lays this out in a wonderful way. And he says, actually, in the book, he says, we have such a hard time understanding that because he says, we've all become proletariats. That's an interesting word he used. He didn't mean that we're all becoming Marxists. But he was arguing that we're all becoming overworked. We've all been fettered to the process of work. We've all kind of adapted a utilitarian mindset that it almost makes it incapable for us to understand this. It's very interesting. In the book, he talks about the way he tries to explain this is to help us understand that in order to understand what a just wage is, you have to understand what an honorarium is. Well, that's a very interesting thought. And here's what he says. He says, when you pay somebody an honorarium, you are honoring them in that work that they have done for you. You don't think that this payment that you're giving to them exhausts what they've given to you. It's just something that one has become honoring. And so what Pieper is attempting to say is that we have to think differently. We have to come often to these questions with a different kind of logic. Again, Benedict actually makes this point in Caritas in Veritate. Here's what he says. Think about this. He says, the great challenge before us, he says, very interesting, the great challenge before us, he says, is to demonstrate in thinking and behavior that in commercial relationships, the logic of gift can and must find its place within normal economic activity. Right? He's saying that the logic of gift has to find its place even in this economic sphere and also the political sphere in terms of when we deal with this question of these types of issues. And he says that if we don't do this, he says, the market governed solely by the principle of equivalence of just exchange goods will not produce the social cohesion that's necessary for it to, in a sense, do what it's supposed to do. So this idea of the just wage is found within this insight. There's a lot more to be said about this, but let me kind of go on to point out that, well, what are the implications of this insight? If one takes this insight seriously, one comes into the question of a discussion of just wages with, I would say, three convictions. And they are dealing with the question of need, contribution, and order. So let me explain each of these three and how they relate to the question of a just wage more concretely. The first one is need. And here we might talk about in terms of a living wage. And a living wage, in the tradition, has always spoke about the idea of being the minimum amount due to every independent wage earner by the mere fact that he or she is a human being with a life to maintain and a personality to develop. Right? And what's at the heart of this idea of a just wage is this, that in order for this, order for these relationships to flourish, right, in order for this relationship to flourish, the employee must recognize that they're surrendering it. That is, you can't have a real relationship when people's needs are not being met. That's why a living wage is so important. Right? If it fails to meet the needs of the employee, they will struggle to carry the weight of a real relationship. This has been a major concern in the Catholic tradition, precisely because if you don't meet people's needs when people have surrendered their full-time work, it is very difficult to have that real relationship. The numbers are absolutely staggering when one starts looking at this, and I know they're changing, and I know all sorts of controversies that come from it, but I often find this graphic to be so revealing, right, that the income is like a champagne glass. And you have approximately 5% of the income coming out of 60% of the people, many of them living on between $1 to $3 a day. Now, there's this very complex data that often people kind of go into about why this is the case and what it means. But it's simply saying we're not doing a great job. We need to do much better. And, of course, the debates will often come about how that happens. And this doesn't even begin to describe the problem. The other issue that one would have to deal with is the question of capital and wealth. This is just income. How do you deal with the question of capital and wealth in this question of distribution? So need, living wage, critical importance. The second one is what we call a contributing, the question of contribution and an equitable wage. And here it says that an equitable wage then is the contribution of an employee's productivity and effort within the context of the existing amount of profits and resources of the organization. Let me put it this way. The principle of need, a living wage, is a necessary but insufficient understanding of what a just wage is about, because it's largely dealing with people's consumptive ability. It's not dealing with their productive ability. I come from Minnesota, and you know in Minnesota we all like to think that we're above average, as often Garrison Keillor likes to tell, but the fact is we're not. And sometimes we have to make decisions, and it's very important. Thomas Aquinas said over 700 years ago, it's a failure of justice when workers are paid the same wages for unequal work and unequal contribution. And so the idea of how you pay according to contribution is riddled with complexity. Let me highlight one particular problem, which many of you, I'm sure, know, and it's the problem of CEO pay. And the numbers are, again, staggering, and how they move from 1980, where it's about 42 to 1, and it actually says it's about 354 today or thereabouts, but actually that has gone down because of the recession. One has to be very clear about this. Leadership matters in organizations. And leaders, in a sense, should be paid more, but they should be paid 354 more. Does that, in a sense, does that get at it? Very interesting. Many businesses have tried all sorts of experiments. I'm sure you know about Ben & Jerry's. Used to have a 5-to-1 ratio, and then they moved to 7-to-1, then they went to 10-to-1, and they simply stopped altogether because sometimes it's hard to get to a particular number. But nonetheless, what they were attempting to do is to say, we have to be just in the contributions that people, that we're paying people. And so that is very important, and again, all sorts of issues that go along with it. We could probably spend the rest of our time just focusing on that. But let me go to the third one, and it's the idea of a sustainable wage, economic order. And a sustainable wage is that an organization's ability to pay wages that is sustainable for the health, the economic health of the organization as a whole. Right? Wages is not just an income, it's a cost. And when you increase wages, it often has impact. And thus, you have to be mindful of the fact about what kind of impact one has in a competitive environment that one finds. If I pay a living wage, and I pay an equitable wage, and I go out of business, that's not a just wage, that's a stupid wage. Now, that's a harsh reality sometimes to deal with. But what the point is about the church's understanding is it's attempting to recognize that one has to recognize that all three of these are necessary to what we might call a just wage. And thus, this raises the big problem of just wages, which is there's lots of tensions when you attempt to pay a just wage. And this is often true for organizations in general. There are tensions as one is dealing with it. So let me give you a case study of this tension. It's a simple case study, and there's a lot of things to be talked about. But Jay mentioned, by the way, that I'm the board chair of a manufacturing company. It's not a big one. He said it was a big one. It's not a big one. It's a small one, actually. It's about 150 people organization. We do have operations in the Netherlands, and we also have offices in China. But back in the late 1990s, the three founders of this organization, which, by the way, had within their kind of what founding documents, that this company is about the practical application of Judeo-Christian values. There were three engineers, three Protestant engineers, and actually one of them was quite intrigued by the Catholic social tradition. He says, these are the intuitions I've always had, but I've never seen them explicated. Right? But back in the 1990s, this was a company that, in a sense, the market wage for their assemblers was about $7 an hour, and they were getting about $14,000 a year. And when they were looking at this, they estimated at that time that a living wage in St. Paul in the late 90s was about $11 an hour at $22,000 a year. And then the question is, well, how do you make up the difference? Because one reality that they were facing is that they could increase this wage to $11 an hour, but their customers actually weren't really interested in paying for that increase in cost or increase in price of what they were going to charge once they would pass that on to others. And they felt that if they simply did it that way, they would be at a competitive disadvantage, which would make them, in a sense, much more vulnerable to the competitive demands that they were going to face. So the question is, what did they do? The first thing I want to be very clear about what they did is that they saw themselves as distributors of justice, not as market technicians. Often when you raise this phenomena or dilemma to people, particularly to business people, they often say, well, I just got to pay them $7 an hour. Nothing else I can do because it's a market. And they abdicate any type of creativity and any type of responsibility to simply the market because this is what the market makes me do. The founders and leaders of this company, in a sense, had a deeper kind of sense of what justice is about, and they said, we can't do that. Because if we're going to have a real relationship with these employees, we have to see this in a much different way. The second thing they did is because they recognized that they were in a market, one of the interesting things they kind of came to was, we're only using $7 of talent here. What if we used $11 of talent? What if we started to redesign the work? What if we thought about work differently? What if we thought about their work differently? Because many of those employees were coming in at an uneducated, unskilled level. And so their point was trying to raise the skill level, which would take cost out of the production process, largely quality controls that were coming from engineers, and had them to expect their own particular quality. And thus they were able to rethink what they were doing in terms of this question of an equitable wage. And thus, they did statistical processing controls, they did all sorts of education that actually, reformulated the work. And what this was able to do for them is that they were able to pay a sustainable wage, because what happened was is they were able to reduce their labor cost at the very same time that they were increasing their labor rates. It's an interesting case. It doesn't solve all the issues, but let me highlight three things about this case that's very important. The first one is, a just wage is not only an exchange or a contract, but it's part of a relationship. They understood that. The second thing they understood was that because it is a relationship, the price of the wage does not exhaust the work that is done. And they thought about the work differently. And thirdly, they recognized that this relationship, when it's guided by these three convictions of need, contribution, and order, they should create a stronger community at work, which will help them become more mission-driven and identity-focused. And that, in a sense, exactly what happened. Because when the employees saw that they started thinking about things differently, they started to respond differently. And it deepened the sense of community of what they had at the workplace that they went to. So let me begin to wrap up with a couple of more what I might call general categories of what might be called institutionally embodied. If you would look at this issue of a just wage, these three categories, a living wage, they really attempted to try to, in a sense, rethink what they were doing with the wage. The other one area that I would also encourage is that some people can do very interesting with benefits. One of the things about this company, and by the way, this was done way before I became the board chair of this company, is that all people have the same benefits. The CEO doesn't have any better benefits than those who are on the lower end of it. Now, there are stock options, he gets bonuses, all sorts of different things, but it's often within a kind of an alignment, recognizing that he is doing certain work. So they were able to, in a sense, they're able to build in this sense that we're all in it together. And so there is an equitable wage. They have bonuses. Let me give you an interesting example. When I was on the board a couple of years ago, we had a new chief financial officer who just came on the board. And when it came to bonus time, by the way, we didn't always make money. There's many years that we didn't make anything. We had nothing. This year we had a very good year, and so we had bonuses. And the CFO came to a board meeting with the plan that actually 3/4 of the people in the company would not receive a bonus. And the founders who were there looked at him and said, "We don't do that here. We don't do that here. Everyone participates in this bonus because they're all contributing to the type of work that they're doing." And lastly, the question of a sustainable wage I mentioned already. Now, that understanding of a just wage, these types of institutionally embodied realities are focused on what might call the micro level, the organizational level. It is also to be said that when we speak about a just wage, we have to speak about it on a political level. And in the Catholic tradition, John Paul makes this very interesting distinction between a direct employer and an indirect employer. The direct employer would be this company that I sit on the board of and all the things they try to do. But John Paul often points out that also what's responsible for a just wage is also an indirect employer, such as unions, such as the state, such as even educational institutions to try to educate people that they can participate within the market. And this, of course, is where we get into a lot of debates. But it does seem to me that the idea of a minimum wage, living wage campaigns, all sorts of different ways in which to try to, in a sense, help people, in a sense, get the needs that they need to have is a very important part of what it means to pay a just wage. With all that said, it should be very clear that once we get into these particularities on both of those last screens, we're going to get into a lot of tension. We're going to get into a lot of debate. We're going to, in a sense, deal with a lot of issues that we may not come to clear agreements in. But that's normal. That's simply part of what it is. And that's why it's very important to have prudence, practical wisdom that animates that. And part of that practical wisdom goes back to the very point that I started off with this. Part of that is necessary to have the imagination, this deep logic of gift that has to animate these types of conversations. Otherwise, they become fragmented. So let me go back to the beginning of my talk, where I talked about the importance of the imagination and the logic of gift. And let me conclude with a quote from Dorothy Day, which I think captures in many respects the heart of what I was trying to do in terms of the beginning of this talk, in terms of the imagination. And she says this about this man, Peter Morin, the person she co-founded the Catholic Worker with. And she said, "He, Peter Morin, did not begin by tearing down or by painting so intense a picture of misery and injustice that you burned to change the world. Instead, he aroused in you a sense of your own capacities for work, for accomplishment. He made you feel that you and all people had great and generous hearts with which to love God. If you once recognized this fact in yourself, you would expect and find it in others. The art of human contacts," Peter called it happily. Peter Morin, Dorothy Day, and so many others in our tradition arouse in us what Barbara Ward calls the upheaval in the imagination, that there is great good that has been given to us, a great gift giver whose love in all that we do cannot be contained by simply a logic of the market or a logic of the contract. John Henry Newman often would explain that the way you address a false idea of a student is to give the student the true idea, and the false idea will fall away. If you only go after false ideas, the student often doesn't have a place to land. This logic of gift is a true idea, and it gives us stability, as St. John says, to go and bear fruit, a fruit that will last. I know there's a lot of quoting of St. Francis, but let me end with my last quote of St. Francis. I'm sure many of you know about it, and actually quoting a sentiment that comes out of Benedict. He said, "It is not by proselytizing that the church grows, but by attraction. And when the church can provide an imaginative vision of the Catholic social tradition that sees the whole, that addresses all of reality and not merely its parts, it will reveal the face of Christ in the world." Thank you very much.